Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin in a moment and get a critique of the intervention in Libya from Stephen Walt, who is a professor of international affairs at Harvard University and the author of an article in Foreign Policy, What Intervention in Libya Tells Us About the Neocon Liberal Alliance. Then we'll go to El Salvador to speak with Professor Raul Hinojosa Ojeda, who has just attended President Obama's press conference in San Salvador and will give us an update on the president's Latin American trip, which has been largely overshadowed by events in Libya. Then finally, we'll talk about the merger between AT&T and T-Mobile that is likely to lead to reduced competition, higher prices, and less innovation from a company already unpopular with consumers that is nevertheless able to dominate the market. Timothy Carr, the campaign director at Force Free Speech and SaveTheInternet.com, joins us. I'm now speaking with Dr. Stephen Walt, who is the Robert and Renee Belfer Professor of International Affairs at Harvard University's Kennedy School of Government. He's the author of The Origins of Alliances, Revolution and War, Taming American Power, The Global Resources to U.S. Primacy. He also co-wrote, along with John Mearsheimer, The Israel Lobby and U.S. Foreign Policy. He currently has an article in Foreign Policy called What Intervention in Libya Tells Us About the Neocon Liberal Alliance. And Stephen Walt, is this this seems to be a sort of tactical intervention in search of a strategic rationale. Do you think that this wasn't thought through because of these people that you cite in your foreign policy piece, Susan Rice, Samantha Powers, Hillary Clinton, others who were haunted by what they didn't do in Rwanda?
Yeah, my suspicion is that they think they have a strategic rationale. I haven't heard one articulated, but I believe that, you know, if you ask them, they would give you a long argument about how this is really in America's interest. I don't think this has been thought through. It certainly hasn't been debated in any significant way. And I characterize the American decision to intervene militarily in the internal conflict in Libya as sort of a Hail Mary pass, right? An attempt to, at low cost, try to affect the situation there quickly, but where, you know, although it might work, you can't be sure it won't. The odds are against it, and it's likely to leave us and possibly also the Libyans in worse shape in not very long.
So is it possible, though, that it wasn't so much in the American interests, but in the interests of protecting the civilians, as the UN resolution states and as the Arab League signed on to?
That's exactly right. I mean, the United States does not have vital strategic interests in Libya. It's not a particularly powerful country. We're not dependent on Libyan oil. And so the fate of Libya doesn't really matter that much. In fact, we had sanctions against the Gaddafi regime for roughly a decade without feeling any particular consequences here. So the only real motivation here was humanitarian, and humanitarian goals are perfectly worthy. So there's nothing particularly wrong with that. But the problem is that the American objective has actually been somewhat beyond just the humanitarian goal of trying to protect the rebels in Benghazi. Even before we decided to intervene, the Obama administration had said that we thought Gaddafi should step down. We've reiterated that ever since. So even though the United Nations resolution focuses solely on protecting innocent lives there, the American objective appears to be to get Gaddafi to leave power. And the problem is it's not clear we can do that just by inflicting air power against his air defenses or against his military.
Well, Stephen Walt, I've talked to a number of foreign policy analysts with experience in that region and military analysts as well. And what I keep coming back to is the subtext that the only strategic rationale that makes any sense is the elimination of Gaddafi, which, of course, is the U.S. and the British have gone to great pains to say that's not their objective. But do you think that really is their objective?
I don't think that there's been an explicit effort to target him, although I can't completely rule it out. I think the American objective is for him to leave power, to give up power one way or the other, whether it's because his military forces eventually abandon him, he decides to abdicate and go to some place that will have him, although my guess is he wouldn't have a lot of options there. I don't know if we're explicitly trying to target him, you know, by some kind of military strike. We clearly want him gone. But as I said a moment ago, the difficulty is that's actually hard to do with air power. You might remember that at the beginning of the Iraq War, we did explicitly try to find Saddam Hussein and target where we thought he might be, and we didn't succeed at that. In fact, we had to invade the country, and we eventually found him hiding in a, you know, underground bunker. But it's very difficult to locate a leader who will, you know, go to enormous lengths to not be found. Basically, the only way we're going to be able to be sure that he's going to leave is if we were to allow the rebel army to win, and that means either intervening ourselves with ground troops or providing them with lots of military assistance so they can ultimately defeat his forces.
And Stephen Walt, in a broader context then, trying to find a strategic rationale here, would it be possible that our leaders and the president, and as you point out, there's clearly a split within his inner circle with Susan Rice, the UN rep, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, and NSC aide Samantha Power wading in on the liberal interventionist side, and Gates and the National Security Advisor weighing in against it. But in terms of a line that's being crossed, the idea that a government can use its military power, modern military power, against its own civilians does seem particularly barbaric. Not that the Russians didn't do it in Chechnya, but my thought is that perhaps there's a rationale here that this will give Ahmadinejad a green light to beat up his people next time they start demonstrating. Syria will probably start doing the same thing. There's some restiveness there. So do you think that this has some kind of value as a signal to other dictators?
I believe that was probably part of the motivation, certainly part of the arguments that were made, that if the United States stood aside while he cracked down on rebels in Libya, that would encourage others. And the United States has, I think, tried to align itself with the forces of change in the Arab world, and therefore people were worried that if we didn't do something about Libya, this would, you know, sort of make the Arab Spring we've been watching a very short-lived phenomenon. The problem is that American policy is quite inconsistent here. We've now gone to war, and that's, I think, the only way to describe it, against Libya. But we've done relatively little in Bahrain, where the government there has cracked down against peaceful demonstrations. We've done virtually nothing in Yemen to try and convince the government there not to crack down on the various people who've been seeking greater openness. So it seems to me that the American policy isn't particularly consistent, and it's probably a function primarily of just how much of a pariah Muammar Gaddafi has been. More importantly, there are lots of places around the world where there are humanitarian outrages taking place. And the point is that when we decide to intervene with in any of them, it's because we've done, hopefully, a careful cost-benefit calculation. Do we think we can actually make things better there at a cost that's acceptable to the American people? And my concern in the Libyan case is that, in fact, we have not thought that through very carefully, that we're hoping that a little bit of military power will change the equation in Libya completely, will lead him to lose power, and then the international community can go help the Libyans rebuild at an acceptable cost. But there's no guarantee that that's actually going to happen. Again, if he hangs tough, if he moves his forces into cities that he still controls so that we can't bomb them without killing civilians, what you may get instead of a quick victory for the forces of good, you may get a stalemate, you may get a protracted civil war, which inflicts enormous humanitarian costs. And it's not clear to me that we've thought this one through, that this may not have been the right place for us to intervene.
Well, Stephen Walt, again, I'm speaking with Harvard professor Stephen Walt, who has an article in Foreign Policy at foreignpolicy.com called What Intervention in Libya Tells Us About the Neocon Liberal Alliance. If this is a new foreign policy to side with the good guys, in the case of Yemen that you just brought up, that's our old policy. We sided with the bad guy. whose son's protecting him with his tanks, while his favorite general is on the other side of town with his tanks, and it's poised for civil war, and all we've cared about there is using them to go after al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, and we've clearly not recognized the democratic stirrings that have been going on in that country.
Yeah, I think that's right. And one could say the same thing with respect to Libya. I mean, Muammar Gaddafi was a pariah, deservedly so, for decades, really. A sponsor of terrorism, someone who had killed Americans, someone who was pursuing nuclear weapons. And then in 2003, he did a deal with us. He agreed to give up his nuclear arsenal, give up his nuclear weapons program. He never had an arsenal. Give up any other weapons of mass destruction he might have been seeking. And he, in fact, was quite adamantly opposed to al-Qaeda, which he regarded as a threat to his own control, and he collaborated closely with the United States ever since on anti-terrorist actions. So we began to bring him in from the cold. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice and the Bush administration actually visited Libya, and we sort of saw them now as an ally in the fight against terrorism. And we've now turned the corner yet again and decided that it was completely unacceptable what he was doing and that we would go to war to prevent it. But as I said before, the main problem here is that our policy isn't really consistent across the region. And therefore, it's not clear to me that what happens in Libya is really going to shape what other governments decide to do.
Stephen Walt, in your article at foreignpolicy.com, What Intervention in Libya Tells Us About the Neocon Liberal Alliance, you say that George Bush left in disgrace and Barack Obama took his place, but he brought with him a group of foreign policy advisors whose basic worldview were not much different from the people they were replacing. So given that George Bush really did embrace the neoconservative wrecking crew, which brought us Iraq, which now, of course, has turned into an Iranian victory, how do you justify that? I mean, surely they haven't done, this crowd hasn't done as much damage as the last crowd.
Right, but that's not saying very much. I mean, I do think the Bush administration sort of set the record for how much damage one could do to America's international position in 8 years. The point to understand, though, is that there's a very strong consensus within the American foreign policy establishment, the sort of inside the beltway a group of people, both Democratic and Republican, about what America's role in the world should be. And I don't want to say it's 100% agreement, but there's quite considerable overlap between the sort of Democratic foreign policy establishment and the neoconservative Republican establishment. These are both groups of people who think that it is America's responsibility and America's right to use all the power at American disposal to shape the world in ways that we like, that we find congenial. They certainly are not, neither group is hesitant about using American power to try and do that, including American military power. Both favor the spread of democracy. This was a pillar of the Clinton administration where many of these people served, and of course it was a key feature of the so-called Bush Doctrine as well. The one disagreement is how they feel about international institutions like the United Nations. So neoconservatives that I would associate with the Bush administration really didn't like the UN very much because they thought it was something that constrained the United States, got in our way, didn't let us do what we wanted. I think the Obama people, the sort of liberal interventionists, actually like the United Nations because it legitimates the use of American power, as we've seen in the last week or so, where we have a resolution now that makes it look completely acceptable for us to do what we're doing. The problem with both groups is they're much better at getting us into conflicts than they are at getting us out of them. And they're willing to use American power, I think, based on not very detailed understanding of the situations that they're inserting us into. So just as the Bush administration got us into Iraq without knowing what they were getting into, I fear that the Obama administration has now committed us to action in Libya without a very clear understanding of how they're going to get us out.
But it seems to me, Stephen Walt, that there's been a pattern since the end of the Cold War where you could go back to the first intervention after the end of the Soviet Union, which was Bush Sr. in Panama, where the United States military invaded a country in order to arrest one criminal who happened to be the head of state. Then we did the same thing in Iraq. We sent vast armies from many countries to go after one man, and we didn't get him. And then we did it again with Bush Jr. And in the interim, of course, Clinton did the same thing going after criminal Milosevic. So is there any way out of this trap where we end up punishing the victims of dictators, whether by military collateral damage or by sanctions, which is the other tool that we use, and essentially we ruined countries in order to remove dictators? It seems deeply dysfunctional. And on the other, and on top of that, the International Criminal Court that's already planning to indict Gaddafi and has indicted the head of state in Sudan. It's one thing to issue an indictment, but it's another thing to arrest these people, and there doesn't appear to be any international mechanism to do so.
Well, I think the post-Cold War world is one where the United States has felt remarkably unconstrained. We have not felt that the actions we could take on the foreign policy stage would ever really come back to bite us. Certainly there was no other comparable power that could retaliate or that could come to the aid of whoever we decided our tyrant of the month was. Now, I would say that the Clinton administration sort of did this rather gingerly. You know, they went into Bosnia somewhat reluctantly. Kosovo was not fought with enormous enthusiasm. So they managed to avoid the real disasters that came later. But they were willing to sort of throw America's weight around, in part because there was no Soviet Union, there was no rival that we had to worry about. The Bush administration took that one step further, and they managed to get us into real problems because they didn't understand the sort of quagmire they were marching into. They were too confident about what American military power could accomplish in each of these places. I do think what we're seeing here is the danger of unconstrained power, that if you have lots of capabilities, if you're the American president, you know that your military can blow lots of things up in various places, and you see bad people doing bad things, it's very hard to resist the temptation to use that capability to try and stop them, even if, in fact, you end up making things worse by doing it. As I said in my piece earlier today, you know, when you have a big hammer, the whole world looks like a nail. When you have thousands of cruise missiles and smart bombs and B-2s and F-18s, the whole world looks like a target set. And again, I think it requires enormous strategic discipline and a clear sense of what the national interest is to be able to resist the urge when someone tells you that a bad person's about to do bad things and maybe, Mr. President, you might be able to stop it. Problem is that in many of these circumstances, we end up making things worse.
Well, just in closing, Stephen Walt, is there a mechanism that can be developed then to deal with bad people, where you've got people down the lower ranks of murderous activities like Mugabe in Zimbabwe and the current thug Gbagbo in Cote d'Ivoire, and then you've got Gaddafi, and then you've got the memory of Rwanda and the others that I mentioned, that we intervened in order to stop them slaughtering their own people. It would seem that the military means don't work unless there's some UN rapid reaction force, but I don't imagine the UN would ever sanction that because of the the composition of their members. So is there anything short of the big hammer?
I think that one does, you know, the one doesn't want to say that you would never respond to a humanitarian crisis. And I do think that, you know, if you see the prospect of real mass killings beginning to unfold or possible genocides, one doesn't want to rule out the possibility of humanitarian intervention. But I do think one has to recognize you can't do it everywhere. I think you have to recognize that you need to know an awful lot about the actual circumstances in a particular place where this is happening to know whether you're going to make things better or you're going to make things worse. And finally, you need to be very careful how often you commit yourself to this kind of enterprise. I believe the whole discussion about what we're doing in Libya would be different, for example, if the United States had not gone into Iraq in 2003 and had we not been bogged down in Afghanistan for now essentially 10 years. The problem is that once you've done several of these things, it makes it very difficult to tackle more of them or to deal with much more serious humanitarian problems in places like the Congo and Cote d'Ivoire and elsewhere. So again, one has to recognize there are opportunity costs here, and just because bad things are happening in one particular part of the world doesn't mean that, you know, Uncle Sam always has to ride to the rescue.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today in Los Angeles, Stephen Walt.
Great. Pleasure talking with you.
Thank you again. I've been speaking with Stephen Walt, who is the Robert and Renee Belfer Professor of International Affairs at Harvard University's Kennedy School of Government. He is the author of Taming American Power, The Global Response to U.S. Primacy, and along with John Mearsheimer, The Israel Lobby and U.S. Foreign Policy. He currently has an article on foreignpolicy.com called What Intervention in Libya Tells Us About the Neocon Liberal Alliance. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll go to San Salvador to get an update on President Obama's Latin American trip. موطني 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 ذا الإباء موطني 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 يا أنا رغم كيد العدا رغم كل النقم سوف نسعى إلى أن تعم النعم سوف نرنو إلى رفع كل الهمم للمسير للعلا Ganamos partidos inolvidables, eliminamos a los que eran grandes, pusimos en la cancha garra y corazón, alentamos a once con pura pasión. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, and I'm joined by Raul Hinojosa Ojeda, who is the founder and director of the North American Integration and Development Center at UCLA, where he researches the political economy of regional integration, focusing on Latin America. He is one of the people who originally proposed the North American Development Bank, which Mexico and the United States created in 1994. He joins us now from El Salvador. Welcome to Background Briefing, Raul Hinojosa Ojeda.
It's a pleasure to be on your show.
And Raul, you've just been at President Obama's press conference in San Salvador. What were the highlights? Because I imagine there are questions about Libya, and of course, Libya has overshadowed this Latin American trip of the president's.
Right. Well, as is typical in these trips, the American press concentrated entirely on issues outside of Latin America. And in the entire questioning was on Libya, but the Latin American press is obviously very focused on U.S.-Latin America relations, which actually this represents a very significant trip for the president at a critical time in American relationships with the in a very rapidly changing region politically. So he didn't make any significant news on Libya. But I thought what was the real news here is, of course, that he came and chose El Salvador, a very small country, 6 million people, but with a very violent political past where the guerrilla movements of the 1980s finally fought the oligarchies to a draw and created a political situation where democracy, to a certain degree, was able to flourish. And now the left wing, the FMLN, the Farimundo Martí Liberation Front, is now a political party which has won the presidency and has won the Congress. And the president, Mauricio Funes, is now the most popular president in all of Latin America. And it's very interesting that, that Obama chose Funes, as well as Brazil, of course, and Chile, but Funes in particular as his anchor in terms of how to rethink a number of very critical issues having to do with left-right dynamics, the emerging new social democratic force as all of Latin America has moved to the left. And through that new political alliance, dealing with very critical issues like immigration, remittances, narco traffic, and poverty. And he's looking, I think, to establish a new type of a dialogue with new types of players, which could, if it works, could be extremely significant for American foreign policy going forward.
Did the president make the references to Libya in contrasting Latin America as countries that are discovering and developing democracy and economic fairness?
Exactly. I think that what was really significant about the trip, instead of talking the old language of U.S. foreign aid, the discussion now is the term is Alliance for the Future, and definitely saying, look, U.S. and the Americas share a very unique history, and as the world is becoming much more integrated, that type of shared values having to do with a non-Euro Eurasian, if you will, both historical and political project are going to become even more important. And of course, the issue that, you know, 25 years, 30 years ago, virtually all of Latin America was military dictatorships, including this country. This country, El Salvador, was basically run by military oligarchic power since the 19th century. And recently, in the last 20 years, all of the military dictatorships have fallen. And as democracy expands, electoral democracy anyway, you have the emergence of left parties and in almost all the major countries now having won the elections. Obviously, Brazil, the most important one, but really significant is, of course, Central America, where they 20 years ago, this was the battleground for the origins of neoliberalism and Reaganism with the U.S. military support of the right-wing military forces against a popular insurrection with a guerrilla movement that was 50 years in the making. And now that new guerrilla movement becomes the interlocutor for many of the aspirations that the United States and clearly Obama wants to express with respect to stabilizing and hopefully developing the region.
Again, I'm speaking with Raul Hinojosa Ojeda, who has just attended President Obama's press conference in El Salvador. He's the founder and director of UCLA's North American Integration and Development Center. The president, in his trip to Chile, was asked, of course, about America's legacy in terms of the pain that country's gone through under Pinochet. And while he didn't accept responsibility, he did say that he felt that the U.S. Would be open to offering up any information that the Chilean government had requested, but he didn't want to dwell on the past. He did, in terms of contrition, say words are easy, and I know that there has been times where perhaps the United States took the region for granted. Any contrition today?
Well, actually, as we speak at this very moment, the president is visiting the tomb of Monsignor Romero, right, the Archbishop of El Salvador that was murdered while he was giving mass by the right-wing death squads. The founder, actually, of the right-wing party, Arena Gabuzón, was his denounced, found to be the intellectual author. of that. It's extremely significant that at this moment the president is at the cathedral. He didn't have to do this. This has created a huge stir in this country and throughout Latin America, as Monsignor Romero, who basically decided in a declaration of liberation theology to support the insurrection and paid with his life, is now increasingly seen as one of the critical heroes of this new democracy movement and progressive change. And the fact that that the president would look back, this is in fact the 23rd anniversary of his murder, in fact, and would choose this as a centerpiece of his trip, I think is extremely significant. And it's curious, the language that he used as terms of why he's doing this, he sees Monsignor Romero as a Martin Luther King figure for Latin America, for the fighting for the poor. So this goes way beyond, I think it's a very personal thing for him too, way beyond anything that you would expect American foreign policy. In just a very few years, a really dramatic change. It was almost worth supporting Obama for this. Obviously, there's another dimension of what he's doing, which is with Funes, who is of the left party, was elected as a part of the left party, is not actually a member of the left party. He's sort of seen as a center left figure. But obviously, there is that dimension of Obama and American foreign policy supporting the good left versus the bad left, the Chavista forces. But there is, nevertheless, the point is the focus of American foreign policy by shifting to support this type of good left is literally generations, light years away of where American foreign policy was just 25 years ago. So I think that there is an indication, and like in Brazil, when when he meets with the president of Brazil, who herself was a left wing guerrilla leader who was in prison and tortured, and is now the leader of one of the biggest economies in the world, a critical player for the United States as it redefines its position within a rapidly multipolar world economy, is an indication that U.S. has actually very little choice, but in fact is now trying to figure out how it can actually make alliance with this emerging new social democratic political project, which involves bringing people out of poverty, which involves a wide series of different types of social, very visible hand of the social policy being critically involved in the future of the economy. Again, very different than even just 15, 20 years ago, with the focus on free trade as the cornerstone of the relationship between the U.S. and Latin America. It's extremely important to keep in mind. The other thing that was kept on coming up and up and up, and in fact there's a number of demonstrations in the streets today about this, is immigration policy, right? You have immigration, a very important issue in this country. About a third of the population is living outside of the borders. About close to 20% of GDP is completely dependent on remittances, and therefore the issue of moving the Salvadorian population, which is a huge population in L.A., second largest Latino population there, it has a very important role in the dialogue, and the president had to strongly reaffirm his commitment to having comprehensive immigration reform, discussing the fact that he wanted to, and he needs to move the Republican Party, that even just when he was in the Senate, he pointed out a few years ago, had voted with Democrats and Republicans for immigration reform, and that he feels the pressure. And the pressure is not just from this country. He feels the pressure politically to deliver for the brothers and sisters of the families here that he's speaking to in El Salvador, and the Latino population, which is of critical importance. So the trip had a definite domestic political force as well, as seeing that he is the spokesman of that other alliance of the future, which is dynamic as the policies he's playing with Latinos in the U.S.
And Raul Hinojosa Ojeda, in Chile he talked about improved cooperation in fighting criminal gangs, trafficking drugs and guns, and illegal immigrants. And, of course, some of that flies in the face of what's happening in Mexico with the 34,000 deaths in the drug war there, which is clearly failing. Did he bring up the drug war? Because I know there's a problem between the U.S. and El Salvador over some of the street gangs that keep going back and forth, getting arrested and deported and redeported.
Well, this is an extremely violent country right now. In fact, more people are dying now than during the Civil War. And a lot of it has to do with street crime connected to Los Angeles. And the danger that they are trying to avoid is that the narco-trafficking gangs, which were basically pushed out of Colombia by Plan Colombia of the United States, and the narco-trafficking groups in Mexico, which are being pushed out of Mexico by Plan Merida, is now going to Central America. So part of what was announced here was Plan Central America. Unfortunately, they announced $200 million of strategic military police aid to try to combat the trafficking. The irony, of course, which was pointed out by a number of analysts we were speaking at a conference yesterday on this issue at the National University, is that while the United States is trying to enlist Central America now in a new strategic struggle against smuggling, the United States is also now, the Obama administration particularly, actually is now deporting more people than did the Bush administration. They are spending more money on ICE and repressive border measures than did the Bush administration. The irony there is what that results in is actually increasing the price that the immigrants that the U.S. economy needs to cross into the U.S. to do the work is now going to feed the smuggler economy. All right. So now smuggling, which used to be almost an artisanal practice of how you would get across the border in Tijuana, now relies entirely on traffickers, professional high cost traffickers that take people through the Arizona desert. That is a direct result of American policy. So there's an ironic contradiction in terms of what the United States is trying to do on the one hand, in terms of dealing with these drug issues, and what people are beginning to say is that we need a process, obviously, of immigration reform. The more quickly you move towards immigration reform and let people flow back and forth across the border, that would actually reduce the income that the smuggling gangs are developing. And of course, moving towards legalization of drugs would also move a long way. So that unfortunately, even Obama, we're still stuck in a sort of police state view of how to deal with the issues of immigration between the United States and Latin America, rather than really coming up with new forms of empowerment. Particularly, immigrant empowerment would be an extremely positive impact for the U.S. economy. We're actually releasing a study on Thursday in Washington at the UCLA Naep Center, where we show that if Arizona was actually able to deport the people that they claim they want to deport through SB 1070, it would cause $100 billion in economic decline in the state. And by the way, 2 weeks later, we're going to release something similar about California and Los Angeles. The alternative of incorporating people, legalizing the flow, empowering workers and empowering migration remittances, the money that people send back, to actually be able to be invested, taking it out of the hands of the informal economy in Western Union and putting it into microfinance and development, that would be a real alliance for the future, which the administration is beginning to look to as an alternative. But they have—they're only taking small steps at this point. But it's at least they're having to focus on it, and the solutions are becoming clearer that the same old practices won't work. And I hope that that's one of the important lessons that the president takes away from his trip.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today in Los Angeles, Raul Hinojosa Ojeda.
Thank you. Very good. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. I've been speaking with Raul Hinojosa Ojeda, who is the founder and director of the North American Integration and Development Center at UCLA. He joined us from El Salvador after having just been at President Obama's press conference there. Let's take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about the AT&T and T-Mobile merger.
Got nothing better to do, talking on your cell phone, dum, 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 walking down the sidewalk, dum, sitting at home with your girlfriend, knowing I wish you'd put it away, that itty bitty cell phone. Drive your SUV, talking on your cell phone, dum, miracle of technology, this magic cell phone, dum, 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 you walking around like it's good to your ear with a high.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, and I'm speaking with Timothy Carr, who is the campaign director for Free Press and the SaveTheInternet.com coalition. He also writes for the Huffington Post and on his personal blog, MediaCitizen.com. Welcome to Background Briefing, Timothy Carr.
Thanks for having me, Ian.
And this merger between AT&T, my understanding, and T-Mobile, my understanding is it's likely to lead to reduced competition, higher prices, and less innovation. And a company already the most unpopular with consumers is nevertheless allowed to dominate the market.
Well, yeah, I mean, to give your listener some idea of the scale of this, if AT&T and T-Mobile were to merge, the wireless marketplace would then be dominated by two companies, AT&T and Verizon, when they would control nearly 80% of the total marketplace. And if you were to look at the oil industry, for example, it would take 10 oil companies to control 80%. So if you know the merger of AT&T and T-Mobile is comparable to the merger of Exxon, BP, Shell, Chevron, Texaco, and Citgo, and it would take that many oil companies to amass that much control over market share. So the problem we face right here is that I think there's no question that we're suffering from a lack of competition as a result of this merger, but we have in the Federal Communications Commission, one of the agencies that is supposed to oversee this merger, a bureaucracy that has been captive to industry interests. So while I think most people would look at this and think this is ridiculous, we need competition in order for markets to thrive, for prices to go down, for innovation to prosper, and the FCC needs to protect that. Unfortunately, this agency doesn't seem to think that it needs to do that. So we're concerned.
So if this merger is approved, AT&T will have about 130 million wireless customers, and Verizon about 100 million, and Sprint about 50 million.
Yes, Sprint would be a distant third, but AT&T and Verizon would control 80%. There are some other firms out there, Metro PCS, which controls about 2%, and some other very smaller firms, but you have two dominant players, and they're not only dominant players in the marketplace, but they're also dominant players in Washington, D.C. There's no corporation that spends more on campaign donations and lobbyists than AT&T. So they basically own Washington, and their expectation is that as this proposed merger goes through the Department of Justice and through the Federal Communications Commission, that they'll be able to call the shots. So one of the things that we're trying to do at Free Press is make sure that consumers are aware of the problems that this presents and that they do contract their federal agencies and say, you know, this is not good enough. if you're going to approve this merger, you also have to attach conditions to it that would protect us from the sort of monopoly tendencies that AT&T is historically known for.
But how many customers does T-Mobile have? Because I'm trying to figure out here. I mean, AT&T is not merging with Verizon. It's merging with T-Mobile, which is even smaller than Sprint.
T-Mobile has 34 million customers. AT&T has right now has somewhere in the area of 95 million. So it's a merger of the second and the fourth largest to create the first largest entity.
And there's no doubt whatsoever, since I'm an AT&T customer, that they have the worst cell phone coverage imaginable. New Yorkers curse at it all the time. iPhone owners have gone into conniptions. There have been jokes about it on the internet and on the late-night talk shows. How does this company – I mean, this company spends more money on PR and advertising than anybody else. You say they have more lobbyists in Washington. They also spend more time trying to convince consumers how great they are against all of the evidence that we have. So I feel like a sucker having AT&T, frankly.
Well, I mean, I wouldn't be so hard on yourself. A lot of people don't have a lot of choices. Yes, AT&T has been voted the worst wireless network out there by customers, and it's also has a history of stifling innovation on its network, of crippling new phones, of shutting out competitors and blocking, you know, blocked certain applications like Google Voice and Slingbox, and is trying to control video streaming over cellular devices. So it's, you know, it has a long history. And that one important point in all of this is also that T-Mobile did provide some competitive pressure as the cheapest of the wireless services out there. T-Mobile customers pay on average 20% less than AT&T customers for their wireless services. So if you're a T-Mobile customer, you have reason to be concerned as well, because I believe as soon as your contract expires, you're going to be forced into a higher payment plan if this merger goes through. And then, again, I say if this merger goes through, because there is a good chance that we can create enough noise that hopefully the Obama administration, the FCC, and the Department of Justice will either stop the merger outright or attach enough conditions to the merger that will be protected against these sorts of abuses.
But it seems to me, though, that AT&T has been really, they're cheap and dishonest, because Verizon have invested in Fios and they've done some innovation. AT&T haven't invested in cell towers and infrastructure. That's why there's so many cell holes and dropouts. Are they going to pick up a new network with T-Mobile so that there'll be – because that to me is the measure of a good corporate citizen, somebody that's actually trying to invest in infrastructure to better serve their customers, as opposed to buying lots of advertising, trying to tell you how great they are, and buying a bunch of crooks on Capitol Hill to carry their legislation.
Well, AT&T has a long history of mergers. They're still working out the kinks of their merger with Bell South, which happened several years ago. That they've a very aggressive history of mergers, basically since the old AT&T or Ma Bell was broken up by antitrust action in the 1980s. But yes, I mean, for them, their idea of investing in infrastructure is not so much to build their own towers, but to buy a company, T-Mobile, that has its own network of towers. So this is how they're spinning this, as an investment in infrastructure that will give them improved coverage area get them to be able to provide AT&T services over a large swath of the country. And the problem with that, though, is that there's a lot of redundancy there. T-Mobile has 40,000 employees. AT&T says the merger will be good for the American workforce, but everybody expects that a lot of those employees will be laid off. T-Mobile has a number of overlapping cell towers that will probably be decommissioned because they cost a lot to maintain, so that the coverage that they're boasting about won't be as robust as they say.
Well, my understanding is that, you know, there's an awful lot of fiber that's been laid, but AT&T, for example, a lot of their cell towers, they end up on an old copper wire going back to the Marbell days because they haven't invested. So if you make a cell phone to a landline, you might as well be back in the 1950s.
Well, AT&T, and this, you know, a lot of the complaints about the AT&T network arose over the last 4 years with the introduction of the iPhone. The iPhone, which was exclusive to AT&T for a time, was sold as the internet in your pocket. That's what Steve Jobs said on day one, is we're giving you the internet in your pocket, and AT&T has marketed it as such. But anybody who, you know, compares the functionality of their iPhone when it's online against a, you know, a cable or a DSL or a fiber connection that they might have through their laptop or desktop computer knows that it doesn't quite deliver on those promises. So yes, AT&T did oversell the iPhone. They not only oversold its capacity, but they also gave you the impression that it could do a lot more than it actually can. And now I'm not saying that this new generation of smartphones are bad. I'm just saying that they've been crippled, and the technology that's there in many ways has been crippled by being attached to some of these networks that are largely dysfunctional.
Again, I'm speaking with Timothy Carr, who is the campaign director for Free Press and the SaveTheInternet.com coalition. But my understanding is that Verizon originally were in negotiation with Apple, and that Apple went to them first because Apple knew that AT&T wasn't anywhere near as good as Verizon in terms of their service. But Verizon apparently, in retrospect, is sorry that they didn't make the deal because I guess it was one of those corporate deals where they couldn't see eye to eye. But that's my understanding of the history of this. So it was never AT&T's first choice to go with, never Apple's first choice to go with AT&T. It was Verizon, and Verizon blew the deal.
Steve Jobs had built such a radical, game-changing device in the iPhone that the way that carriers had dealt with devices that came along prior to the iPhone were that they would have almost complete control over the applications on the device and complete control over where those users could go on the network. And Jobs said, well, that's not going to work, and he drove a hard bargain. I guess it was too hard for Verizon, so that when he went to AT&T, they decided it was worth tearing down some of their walled garden. The walled garden is a term that cell users might be familiar with. It's the way these carriers have treated internet access by walling you off from certain parts of the internet and applications. And AT&T decided to tear down a lot of those barriers in order to get exclusive access to the iPhone.
Well, it is, you know, there's a history in corporate America of the consumer ending up with the worst technology, even though there are people that invent great technology. For example, the RCA television, the 480 lines, that was because of the market muscle of General Sarnoff, and we ended up with the worst television in the world, and, you know, VHS versus Betacam. There's been all these choices over the history of innovation. Of course, innovation is happening much more fast and furious nowadays. Is it likely that, I mean, I'm trying to look for some good news here because this looks like this doesn't seem like anything for the consumers to feel good about in this deal. Will they, the prices are not necessarily going to go down, at least to T-Mobile's levels, but you think maybe the service will go up?
Well, I mean, I think the good news is that people have realized the power of a smartphone. And we, for a great deal of time, we took for granted that our cell phones could only do so much. And now that a lot of these smartphones, and some of them are even on more open platforms like the Android, have shown us that we should be able to do with a handheld device anything that we can do on our laptop or a desktop computer, and the sort of freedom that we have every time we go online to be able to go to every website that we want or download whatever services we want, use whatever applications we want, should be transferred to our handheld device. There's no difference.
Right. Well, I'm afraid
going online with a cell phone and going online with another device, and it's more and more people.
I'm afraid we've run out of time here, Tim. But
what's that?
I'm afraid we've run out of time here. I've got to end this. But I thank you so much for joining us here today. Again, Tim Carr, campaign director for Free Press and SaveTheInternet.com Coalition. Well, let me just give you a wrap up of today's program to see what I learned and hopefully what you learned. The first guest, Stephen Walter, co-author of a very controversial book about the Israeli lobby, he gave a fairly contrarian view of what's happening in Libya. His critique is that there's not a lot of difference between the neoconservatives from the Bush administration and the liberal interventionists in the Obama administration. One group, of course, was contemptuous of the UN because they felt that it constrained American power and they wanted to go it alone. And the other group, the Obama group, feel that the UN is useful so that they can give their blessing to the use of American power, which is his argument about what's happening now in Libya, where we're intervening without any concern or understanding of a strategic end game. And when I pressed him about whether or not there was any other way to organize this world, when you've got so many despots killing their own people in African countries and throughout the Middle East, is there a mechanism where we don't have to go to war against countries in order to arrest the dictator? We're killing all these innocent people whose only crime is that they live under a dictatorship as collateral damage, or we're imposing sanctions on them. We didn't really come up with an answer there. So that was a very interesting interview because it certainly gave us a lot to think about. And clearly the indications are that this thing wasn't thought through particularly well before we went into Libya. Then we went to El Salvador to speak with Raul Hinojosa Ojeda, who's just attended President Obama's press conference there. That's a very thorny situation there, the way he presented it, particularly in terms of drugs and immigration. He said that what got my attention was that clearly the war on drugs is actually destroying El Salvador and lots of Central American countries that have become haven for drug traffickers. And the street gangs out of Los Angeles are recycled through El Salvador, creating tremendous problems for this small country surviving from years of civil war. He pointed out that Plan Colombia drove the cartels into Mexico and Plan Merida drove the cartels out of Mexico into Central America. So that was an interesting, albeit unfortunate, revelation about how dysfunctional war on drugs is making it impossible for us to improve conditions in Latin America, which, of course, the president was celebrating that throughout Latin America, making the distinction between Libya, where all the press, of course, were asking questions about Libya, trying just to turn the subject to Latin America, saying how these are countries that were under former military dictatorships and now are democracies with much more diverse economies. That message clearly was a little lost on the audience, the international audience and the press corps traveling with him who weren't interested in local issues. But I suppose the president felt he had to take this trip, so it wouldn't look as if this situation in Libya was such a big deal. Then finally, we talked about the AT&T T-Mobile merger, where the number one company, the most unpopular and the worst in terms of consumer satisfaction, has joined with the number four company to make this an extraordinary behemoth. Tim Carr from Free Press told us that the merger would be the equivalent of most of the big oil companies in this country coming together. So that was really an extraordinary perspective to have on how could the company with the worst track record, the least consumer satisfaction, suddenly dominate the market. And you better believe that we will be getting reduced competition, higher prices, and less innovation in the future. So I'd like to thank producers Spencer Downing and Kim Nassiter and associate producer Erica Rivera. Our theme music is by Los Lobos. You can hear this program, sign up for podcasts, and contact me at ianmasters.com. I'm also writing a daily blog. You can go to ianmasters.com and click on blog. You may leave comments and I'd love to know what you think. And I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another background briefing. Bye for now. Standing along the side of a pickup truck.